Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case should never have ended the way it ended. What we have here is a very complex financial transaction, a tax credit transaction that involved multiple loans, involved tax credits, involved equity injections, etc. And what happened is the FDIC sold one piece of the transaction, which was bought by the appellee. If we look at it from a holistic standpoint, the way the transaction was supposed to work and the way tax credit transactions work, at the end of the day, the original loan, the bridge loan, which is what's being sued on here, should have been paid for by the tax credit. With the bridge loan, like a construction loan, interim financing, it's the beginning of a transaction. And so what happened is that rather than the trial court viewing it holistically, that this was part of an entire network of interconnecting transactions, it allowed the appellee to proceed as if it was a one-off transaction. That was the problem. Now, why are we here? We're here because although there were numerous genuine issues of material fact, the trial court ignored those, granted summary judgment, and cast the appellants in multiple judgments totaling $1.8 million. Now, one of the problems we had here, our affirmative defenses included the fact that there was two credit memos. Anybody affiliated with banking knows that it's the credit memo that sets the stage and describes for everyone what the transaction is about. Now, we have three handouts that I'm going to use in oral argument, and those handouts, I think, flesh out exactly what we're trying to say. There's two credit memos, one from 2012, the next one from 2015, and then there is a memorandum that was attached to it that goes on basically to describe what the maximum exposure was for the appellant. Now, if you look at its record, let's see, Record on Appeal, page 1810, that's the 2012 credit memorandum. And one of the issues here that the trial court was having was whether or not it was signed. Okay, we basically argued as an affirmative defense and said, look at this. Even though the promissory note was for $1.5 million, the transaction was basically not to ever have the appellants have to pay this thing back. All right, tax credit transactions are set up in such a way where each of the separate loan transactions offset each other. So at the end of the day, what happens is, here's a 7-year period. At the end of the day, you come and you pay a nominal sum, transfer fee of $1,000, $8,000 in attorney's fees, and it's all over with. All right, now, so what we basically said was, Your Honor, take a look at these credit memos. We were hit with the Dench Doom defense, which basically says FDIC can sell things and, you can't go outside the promissory note. Well, you can under Dench Doom if you can show that there was a written agreement, that agreement was part of the record, and it was signed by the parties. And one of the issues we had, which is a genuine issue of material fact, was whether or not Dr. Ottman actually signs. Now, we had great difficulty in getting these documents. We made three FOIA requests on the government. The first FOIA request came back, we're not giving you anything. The second FOIA request came back with the 2012 memo, a credit memo, and then the third FOIA request came back with the 2015. And what we had here was, you'll notice on there, there's like areas that are grayed out, areas that show that something's blocked out. It shows B6, whatever, where signatures were. It might show B4 or something else. And so our problem is you can't really see the signature because it's blocked out. And what the government does is it blocks out account numbers, it blocks out signatures, anything that somebody might be able to use and fraudulently engage in fraudulent behavior. Our point was this, was Judge, look, next to our client's name is where it's blocked out. That's where the signature was. And the judge basically says, well, I'm looking at this, but it's not really clear whether he signed it or not. And I'm saying, Judge, once you reach the conclusion it wasn't clear, that created a genuine issue of material fact. And you should have allowed us then to go back again to the federal government and say, look, can you give us an unredacted document? Okay, or allow an affidavit from our client who would say, yes, I signed it. So I think what we have here is the unusual situation where...
So you're saying if you were able to produce a signature,
yes,
you would meet all the other requirements under Dinch Doom?
Yes, and I think we do. And if you look at 2015, you'll see that underneath where they blotted it out, looks like there's a signature there. And that's why the judge said it was unclear. So if you look on this, it's record of the Court of Appeal, page 2347. And if you look at the top...
So you've got a date that would show it's contemporaneous with...
It was signed the same day as... What happened is this. In 2012, the original bridge loan was signed. Transaction started. There was a delay in getting tax credits. And so what happened is they amended the original bridge loan, upped it by $100,000, okay, with the idea that, hey, we have additional expenses that have incurred.
I just want to be sure, because I'm looking at four things under this Dinch Doom doctrine, and I just want to be sure you're telling me,
but for a signature, every
other requirement
is
met.
And we say there was a signature, so there really isn't even a but-for. We're basically taking the position we met all of the requirements. The other thing is this, is that one of our affirmative defenses is fraudulent inducement. We're basically saying, Ashley Ryan, who's currently in jail, Brad Calloway, who's currently in jail, fraudulently induced our client to put up his property and to sign all of these various documents. Now, and so we're saying that even if you said we could not vary the terms of the note because of Dinch Doom, I think the credit memos also show the fraudulent inducement because they basically say, if you look at Record on Appeal document 2351, it basically says, should there be a shortfall which could result on interest accruing while awaiting the state certifications, the personal cash flows of Dr. Eugene Ockman can easily support up to a shortfall of $125,000. Okay, basically, they're basically saying, worst case scenario, the most this guy was going to owe is $125,000.
That's in the credit memorandum?
That's in the credit memorandum. And that's the interoffice memorandum that's dated January 26th with Brad Calloway, who's the loan officer and the executive vice president who's on this and who convinced our client to sign all these documents. Well, but basically, anybody familiar with a taxpayer transaction knows that it's a lot of fictions. Okay? So what you have here is a series of notes. You have a leverage loan. The leverage loan, our client's company was not the borrower on the leverage loan. They were the lender. And they loaned the money to the tax credit entity. Okay? You're still going, how can you wear all these hats? That's the way a taxpayer transaction works. Now, at the bottom of all this funnel where the money's coming down, you end up with what they call Kalicki notes, okay? And the Kalicki notes, A and B, all right? Now, on the Kalicki notes, that's where you get to the real estate, the Corbett Theater property. It's all the way down the line. But what you have here is, at the end of the day, Kalicki note B and Kalicki note A get wiped out. One becomes a permanent subsidy, that's the B. Loan A gets wipes out the leverage loan. Now, why is the leverage loan important? Our client was the lender on the leverage loan. $2.9 million. That was put in the account by the bank, and the interest on that was to pay and keep current the interest on the two Kalicki notes. Now, here's where the problem comes. The bank fails in 2017. Up to the failure of the bank was making those payments from the account. Once the FDIC took over, it stopped making the payments. I think they call that a default. That's the true default that the trial court never let us proceed with. Secondly, what happened is FDIC sells the notes to a company called OSK. They don't make the payments, interest payments on the Kalicki notes either, another default. Then buy equities, the appellee in this case ultimately acquires the paper and it doesn't make them either. So what we have here is you're pointing at the wrong actor in terms of defaults. The defaults occurred when the bank failed and the FDIC, which stood then in the shoes of the bank, dropped the ball. Now, we have over $4 million in tax credits and the appellee says, I had a note for $1.5 million. Well, it's easy to see that if the tax credits had been applied the way they should have been, there would have been no debt owed on the note that's being sued upon in this court. And what we're basically saying is that there were several genuine issues of material fact that the trial court just glossed over. And the trial court went so far as to say, well, look, even if you could prove and get around Dent's Dome, the guy signed the guarantee agreement. Well, let's look at that logically. A guarantor says, I agree to pay up to what the primary obligor has to pay. If the primary obligor only has to pay $125,000, why should the guarantor have to pay $1.8 million? It logically doesn't make sense. It defies any concept of law one might have, and it runs contrary to Louisiana's civil code, which basically, you know, says that the obligation of a guarantor is accessory. It's accessory to what? The obligation of the primary debtor. And so it can't be higher. But in this case, because of what happened, that's the fiction you have. You have a fiction here where Home Theater Productions' maximum liability is $125,000, but the guarantors, who are really the appellants in this case, have been cast in judgment, are basically stuck with $1.8 million debt. Now, for some people, that's not a lot of money, but for my client, Dr. Ottman, that's a bet the ranch kind of situation. That basically is something he didn't anticipate. That's something he was told would never happen. And I say, if the trial court had taken a holistic approach to looking at the transaction, we would have seen that there's no way possible for there to be a debt owed on the bridge loan. It's a bridge loan, okay? The tax credits basically pay off the bridge loan. Now, why didn't this happen? Take a look at it. The tax credit transaction basically trues up after 7 years. You have to have a 7 year period. At the end of 7 years, what happens is the bridge loan gets paid off with the tax credits. The other indebtedness true up with one another and get paid off and washed out. All right. And then at the end of the day, you have that little transfer fee of $1,000 and $8,000 for legal fees on the entity that you're dealing with. That's the way it's supposed to happen. The FDIC should never have sold the bridge loan as an isolated transaction. It wasn't an isolated transaction, and in fact, it was really a fiction because there was never going to be the possibility of a default if the transaction had gone the way it went. Now, let's talk about defaults. The bridge loan...
I guess I'm trying to understand. What you're saying is this is a loan that only had to be paid back if it was paid back with tax credits.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. And let me explain where the glitch came in. The seven-year period. The loan, the bridge loan, matured in 2016, the year before the bank failed. All right? Keep that number there. Now, what would happen then is the 7 years would run from 2012, which was when the loan was originally done, to 2019. The bank failed in 2017, 2 years before the seven-year period came up. Now, remember, the FDIC took over, was supposed to stand in the shoes of the bank. The bank was supposed to keep its Kalicki loans current. Okay, the bank was supposed to do all that. That stopped. And so what happened is, instead of somebody moving the tax credits over and saying, tax credits wipe this out, it didn't happen. Now, my client should not be punished because it didn't happen. It should have happened. The transaction, if you look at the entire transaction, contemplated that that would happen. Now, there's some other genuine issues. My client is the lender on a leverage loan. Loaned in $2.9 million. Was put in an account at First NBC Bank. We have a genuine issue of material fact. Where is the money? Where is it? At this point in time, we were not even allowed by the trial court to go down that road to say, where's the money? Where is it? What happened to it? So, the simple resolution of this case, we think, is for this court to vacate the summary judgment and the attendant monetary judgments, remand the case back for further proceedings, and hopefully we get a trial on the merits where we can do a number of things. One of the other things that the court did was it closed the file after it granted this and ignored our third-party demand, which was based on the fraudulent inducement. So we never even got to even proceed there. I think the court just basically said, well, it's over. You know, the people who you brought the fraudulent inducement came, they were convicted. You know, they're in jail. So it's over with. It's not over. And respectfully, I suggest to you that my client be allowed to have his day in court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ayer.
May it please the court. Charles Stern on behalf of the appellee and plaintiff below, BY Equities. What you just heard from Mr. Aaron demonstrates exactly why the Dench Doctrine exists, demonstrates exactly why it was codified in 12 U.S.C. 1823E. His whole contention, based on some credit memos from 2012 and 2015, was that his client was fraudulently induced into signing the documents for this so-called bridge loan. The 2015 note typically has been referred to in the litigation as the new bridge loan. Dench and the subsequent Supreme Court decision in Langley make clear that fraudulent inducement by the lending institution that has subsequently failed is not a defense that is cognizable under federal law. I'm going to a brief quote. This is from Macklemore versus Landry, which is a 1990 decision from this court. Following Langley, we have held that misrepresentations to borrowers cannot be asserted as a defense to recovery by the FSLIC on facially unqualified loan documents. The case is dated a little bit because the FSLIC doesn't exist anymore, but back in the early 90s, there were plenty of cases involving failures of savings and loans. And a lot of them were in Louisiana and Texas, so there's plenty of Fifth Circuit law. The whole point of those decisions and of the subsequent codification of the decisions is to prevent exactly what's going on here. The FDIC is charged with liquidating the assets of the failed institution. Those assets consist primarily of loans. It sold its bridge loan to an outfit called OSK, totally unrelated to any of the parties here. OSK subsequently sold it to BY. We're protected by the same protections under Dench that apply to the FDIC. So in order for a document, oral misrepresentations are clearly not cognizable against us. They may have been valid against FNBC, but that's not something for us to determine. So let's look briefly at the only two documents that they rely on. There's this 2012 credit memo. Well, it fails for a couple of reasons. It fails under 1823E1 because it's not executed contemporaneously with the 2015 loan. And by the way, the court below assumed, without deciding, that Dr. Ottman had signed these things. Its decision was based on the contents of these documents and on the fact that everything else that was offered below by the defendants consisted of oral misrepresentations, or alleged oral misrepresentations.
The statute, I'm looking at the statute, E1B, that's what we're talking about, E1B.
I believe it's B.
That the agreement has to have been executed by the depository institution and any person claiming an adverse interest thereunder, including the obligor, contemporaneously with the acquisition of the asset by the depository institution. Help me apply that to these facts. Right.
The asset in this case would be the 2015 New Bridge Loan.
Okay, New Bridge Loan 2015.
Okay. The original tax credit transaction is 2012. That's why you see dates from 2012, but the loan at issue here was in 2015.
Okay, and when was that? That's the asset.
That is the asset that was ultimately acquired.
When was it acquired by the depository institution? I'm just trying to zero in on
that. It was acquired when the loan document, when the note was executed for 2015.
Okay. So you're saying of this first one of the flaws you're saying is that it's not contemporaneous because it's 2012.
Right. But there's a second flaw.
Okay.
Right. Essentially what Mr. Aaron is trying to say is because there was an expectation that the loan in 2012 and the loan in 2015 were going to be paid off by tax credits, that he's trying to convert that into an agreement that the loan could only be enforced by essentially grabbing the tax credit. That's not what this document says, and it's not what the loan documents say. All the loan documents are in evidence. What this document says is there's a primary source of payment. The primary source of payment was expected to be the tax credits. But there's also a secondary source of payment, right there on the document. This is the 2012 document, but you'll see something similar in 2015. And the secondary source of repayment is guarantor support, and the guarantors are listed, and liquidation of collateral. And the collateral does not just include tax credits. The collateral includes assignment of map in 2012, all sorts of other things, all sorts of assignments. So right there on the face of the document, it's saying we expect, you know, the plan is it's going to be paid off by tax credits. But there is no agreement that is only enforceable against the tax credits. It's just like I execute a mortgage. The plan is that my income is going to support that loan. But I execute the mortgage because things don't always go according to plan. And that's what this document shows. There is nothing here that says or restricts the ability to collect on this loan to tax credits. I have no idea what happened to the tax credits and why it didn't pay off the loan. That's the whole point of Dench. I don't need to know. What I need to know, or what DY needs to know, is there's a note, there's a security agreement, there's a guarantee, and the note's unpaid. And all of that evidence is in the record. And they don't contest any of that evidence. Their position is we were bamboozled by people at FNBC. We were led to believe that this note would be paid off by tax credits, and it wasn't. And therefore, BY Equities coming in years later, buying this loan 7 years after the original transaction, for almost 5 years after the 2015 loan, which turned out at the end of 2016. This note was in default from 2016 forward. The 2015 document has an additional problem, which is it was not presented in opposition to the summary judgment motion. It wasn't even requested in a FOIA request until late August of 2024, about a week before the discovery cutoff in this case. They filed it in connection with the Rule 60 motion. Case by late 2024 was over 4 years old. They had gotten the 2012 memo in early 2021. Under Rule 60B, they have to, if they're going to come up with newly discovered evidence, they have to demonstrate that they exercised reasonable diligence in trying to get it. And the lower court found that they had. And that is reviewable only on the basis of abuse of discretion. But Judge Barbier also went on and said, with respect to the 2015 memo, the same thing that I just said about the 2012 memo. Again, it lists guarantors, it lists collateral, the UCC on all accounts, notes, and pledges receivable of the debtor. In this case, the debtor is Harvey Theatre Production. Even under the financial reporting requirements, this is, by the way, their exhibit. It's 2347 of the record. under financial reporting requirements, annual tax returns and financial statements on borrower, annual tax returns and financial statements on both guarantors. Why do you make that a requirement if this is a note that can only be paid by tax credits and will never require anyone else to come up with payment? When you buy a note and loan from the FDIC, you are entitled to rely on the loan document, not on some understanding, not on some representation, not on everybody's expectation that it's going to be paid off with tax credits. The whole point of security is that expectations don't always pan out the way you think they're going to. And you have backup. It's security. It is not your primary mode of payment. That's the whole point behind Dash. And part of what Mr. Aaron is doing is he's trying to complicate what is ultimately a fairly straightforward issue. He's talking about everything that everyone expected was going to happen, the way these tax credit deals were structured. A lot of that isn't in the record. But it's a suit on a note. It's about as simple a case as you can get. They do not contest any of the basic elements of the suit. They don't contest that they executed the note. They don't contest that they executed the security agreement. Why are you going to execute a security agreement if it's just payable from tax credits? They don't contest that Ottman executed a guarantee. They don't contest that the note matured. They don't contest that there was a balance due approximately $1.6 million at the time BY purchased the note. They don't contest they never paid it. Their answer is to blame FNBC. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that FNBC was a well-run machine. It's been dead now for 8 years. The two officials that they went after in their third-party demand, Mr. Aaron mentioned, you know, one of them's in jail, and that's the other one may be out by now. But that's not BY Equity's issue. It's really fairly simple. And by the way, the other thing that they did, because there were basically three affirmative defenses that they went for. The fraudulent inducement one was the first one that came up, and it's the one that they spent the most time on. But they also accused BY of various kinds of misconduct, unfair trade practices. And what the evidence shows, and this sort of dovetails as well with the Dench argument, is their unfair trade practices are based on the fact that BY was negotiating with the then holder of the note, which was OSK, which bought it from the FDIC, at the same time that their client was negotiating with OSK about a possible workout, and that we knew they were negotiating. Well, notes are freely assignable. OSK can cut the best deal it wants. That's not an unfair trade practice. I mean, there's a pattern here of everything is everybody else's fault. BY Equities is just an investor. It buys a note. If the note is in default, it's either going to get paid on the note or it will execute on the security. That kind of transaction happens thousands and thousands of times every day. There is a recognized market in defaulted loans. That's all BY Equities did is buy a defaulted loan. Everything else that happened afterward was BY trying to collect on the note. This suit was filed about 6 months after it purchased the note, or 5 months actually. It's been pending now for over 5 years. There was a two-year stay while the criminal proceedings in the FNBC case were being handled. The note has been in default now for close to 9 years. No one denies that the note was unpaid. They admitted it in their answer. The note was never paid. Their position is, well, it can only be, essentially, what they're trying to sell here is that the note could only be paid from the tax credits. That is contrary to the documents themselves, including the documents they're relying on. There is no such agreement. Fraudulent inducement is not a defense. There is no evidence of any unfair trade practice or fraud by EY Equities. It's just buying a note.
Could you address, Mr. Aaron, the third exhibit that has been given to us as an interoffice memorandum from January 26, 2015? And you drew our attention to the this paragraph about the personal cash flows of Dr. Eugene Oppmann.
Right. I think that's the fifth of the bullet points.
Right.
Right. This is an internal bank document talking about what they think Dr. Oppmann's personal guarantee might be able to cover. I mean, I can't dispute that that's what it says, but it has nothing to do, again, with the terms of the loan documents. That is what Dench and that is what 1823E require the courts to focus on, because otherwise, people in OSK's position or BY's position are never going to buy these notes at failed institutions. By their nature, failed institutions are not necessarily well-run. And there may be all sorts of things hidden away somewhere. I mean, that's what Dench was about. Supposedly, there was a secret deal that some note that looks like it's just a regular note wasn't ever going to have to be paid. And the Supreme Court said, well, not once the FDIC has to take this over, it has to rely on what's in the files. So this internal credit memo is talking about what they can expect to collect from Dr. Oppmann, but that's got nothing to do with the rights of a subsequent acquirer of the note, which has got Dr. Oppmann's guarantee, it's got a UCC security agreement, that among other things, gives the holder of the Newbridge loan a security interest in any notes that are held by Mr. Aaron's client. That's what a buyer of the loan is entitled to rely on. And that's what BY relied on. You know, I'm not here to defend FNBC, but I am here to say it doesn't matter what FNBC did unless it specifically agreed that it would only attempt to collect the note from the tax credits. They're in rem mortgage loans.
I mean, what I hear you saying is there's not even an agreement. In your view, there's not even an agreement to do that.
No.
Yes, that's the primary source of repayment, but there are other sources of repayment.
Correct. Correct. They're trying to argue that that's what the agreement is, but if you think about in rem mortgage loans, it's express. The loan can only be enforced against the property. Those kinds of loans are made in commercial context all the time. That could have been done here, but it wasn't. They did exactly the opposite. They did what most lenders do, which is rely primarily on cash flows, or in this case on tax credits, and then secondarily on security. Their complaint is with Ashton Ryan and Brad Calloway at FNBC. And essentially they're saying, Dr. Oppmann got snookered into making this loan, Dr. Oppmann being the principal of Carver Theater Productions as well as an individual guarantor. I'm not here to offer a view on that one way or the other. My people weren't there. Dench says they don't have to have been there. They're entitled to rely on the documents. So unless there are any further questions, I will cede my last 35 seconds and sit down.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, we claim fraudulent inducement, but we also allege that BY Equities conspired with others to basically infiltrate the company hire one of their operatives as an employee to gain information, to gain access to the day-to-day operations and any vulnerabilities that my client might have. We also claim that they tortiously interfered with our attempt to buy the load from OSK, who they bought it from. And basically what happened is this. We were basically saying, look, OSK, you can't enforce this thing for the full amount, because that was never the intention. They come in and say, well, look, while they're trying to negotiate, we'll just pay you the full amount and knock them out. And that's how it went down. The other problem with what they're saying is this, is that they also tried to interfere with us dealing with the tax credit entity on the unwind. And if you notice in the pleadings, you'll see the unwind was an issue. Basically, all we're saying is this. There were a lot of moving parts in this thing, and the trial court did not allow us to explore all the moving parts, the third-party demand, et cetera. Okay, all we did was just get cast in judgment and in a situation where it was clear that neither Carver Theater Productions, which was a company, a brand new company, had no assets, no credit score, nothing, okay? That basically what was driving this thing was the tax credits. This loan was made to the Carver Theater, a historic property rising out of segregation when theaters were not open in the Treme section in New Orleans. The whole basis was this. We want economic development in this poor area. Okay, Dr. Opel can't afford to do it. Nobody in their right mind is going to come in and put $8 million into this. So how do we do it? We find folks who need tax write-offs, credits. We sell those, and that's how we're able to do the project. And so what we're basically saying is this. There are several genuine issues of material fact, notwithstanding what he's saying. They go beyond just the dense dome issue, and the trial court should not have granted summary judgment in the face of genuine issues of material fact. That's why we're here. Now, let's look at dense dome. Problem is this. I think, you know, it's a rare occasion when somebody can basically overcome dense dome. I think we are able to do it. It took us three attempts. Through FOIA requests, we tried through discovery. We got a deemed admission from Ashton Ryan, who basically was avoiding, but we served requests for admissions. He admitted in there that the tax credits were to have paid the deal off. So, okay, that's not an issue. What we're basically saying is this. The FDIC, looking at it in hindsight, never should have sold this separately. They should have sold it as a package. But By and OSK, its ancestor and title, were sophisticated players. What they should have done is said, look, let me look at this file. Give me the file. And if they looked at the file, they would have seen the credit memos, and anybody looking at it would have gone like, whoa.
Well, what's your response? Mr. Stern says, yeah, the primary source of repayment on the credit memo is tax credit equity proceeds of the state, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a secondary source, and there are also guarantors on the credit memo.
That's true. So a genuine issue of material fact is, what is the actual liability of the guarantor after application of the tax credits? That's a genuine issue of material fact. The trial court didn't look to see, okay, what happened to the tax credits? Because they went in. They were received. What happened to them, and why were they not applied? And so what we're basically saying is, the trial court could have allowed us to show what they were, we know now, is $4 million. And had they been applied, the $4 million, it would have basically wiped out the $1.8 million judgment that he has. And so I think, you know, what we're saying is, give us the opportunity to show not only, you know, what should have happened, but was there money available to take care of this? I think we're able to show. We can show that you got state historic tax credits came in, federal historic tax credits came in, new market tax credits came in, and also live entertainment tax credits came in from the state of Louisiana. And we can show it came in. And if we show it came in, it should have been applied to the bridge loan. And that's what we're saying. We wanted an opportunity to be able to show that, and the trial court denied us fundamental fairness and an opportunity to do that. That's what we're saying here. And notwithstanding what Mr. Stern is saying, he's just saying, well, we bought this and whatever. To that argument, I say, well, you bought it, but you should have looked in the file. If you looked in the file, you'd have seen the credit memo. And it should have given you pause that, whoa, maybe we're buying a pig in a poke here, that really we're buying a note that really never went into default. That's my time, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement. That concludes the matter scheduled for oral argument.